we come to our text for this morning, Jesus is walking along with his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane. Everybody knows that we are at the last night before Jesus is crucified the next morning. And as he's walking with his disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane and he is giving them last words, he is giving them last words of encouragement. And his words, I think, are relevant not only to these 11 disciples, but also to all those in all ages who would believe on him through their testimony. And this means, of course, you and me. Take a look at John chapter 17. Just flip over a page. And when Jesus prayed for them at this last moment, in verse 20, John 17, 20, he said, "Neither pray I for these alone," that is, for these 11 disciples, "but for them also which shall believe on me through their word." Did you know that Jesus prayed for you? And I think in these instructions to the disciples that he also is instructing us. So these final words of Jesus are very important words, and they are actually very loving words. They are words as from a father to his children. They are words from a master to his servants. And most importantly, they are words from the head of the church to the church. And you might remember that in chapter 15, this little church was characterized by three things. First of all, they were characterized by abiding in Christ. This whole vine analogy is about abiding. Those who are true disciples of Christ are the branches who continue in a vital connection to the vine. And this was the source of their life and their vitality. A branch disconnected from the vine withers and dies. And Jesus reinforced to his little band of followers the necessity of continuing in the faith. And Jesus, in fact, in this dialogue, he teaches them, told them over and over, "Abide in me." Now, this is the crux and the heart of Christianity. It is abiding in Christ. The greatest danger for every professing Christian is not trials or temptations or sufferings or even persecution, but it is apostasy. If you are connected to the vine, Jesus will get you through all of these other things. But the greatest danger is that you will walk away from Him. The greatest danger is that you won't continue to believe and trust in Him. And if you were to cast away your faith, you would prove to be a false branch and an apostate to the faith. And for this reason, Jesus did not hesitate to emphasize, even to his own disciples, that they must abide always in him. We must never forget that we are helpless without his strength and his power, and so we must abide in him. And the second characteristic of a true disciple is that he will bear fruit. Jesus said in John 15:5, "I am the vine, and you are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me ye can do nothing." A connected branch will not be a fruitless branch. A fruitless branch indicates a disconnect from the vine, you see. A fruitless professor of Christ is a mere professor of Christ. If Christ is not flowing through your life, then fruit is not hanging from your branch, and the husbandman will soon come and cut you off and cast you to the ground, and you will be gathered up to be burned. So a true Christian is an abiding Christian and a fruit-bearing Christian. And thirdly, a true Christian is a loving Christian. Now, verses 9 through 17 of chapter 15 focuses on this defining characteristic of Christ's church. This little church, which belongs to Christ, is characterized by that little word called love. In fact, we saw last time that love flows in every direction in this Christian community. The Father loves the Son. The Son loves the Father. The Son loves His disciples. The disciples love the Son. And lastly, the disciples love one another. And so Jesus said, "This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you." And so we have this little community where love is flowing all around and all seems well. And you might think that all troubles are now past for this little church, except for one little problem. This little loving community is situated smack dab in the middle of a world that is characterized by hate. The first half of chapter 15 is about a loving father and a loving son and loving disciples. And the last half of chapter 15 is about a world that hates them. It says in John 15:18, "If the world hates you, ye know that it hated me before it hated you." The world is a different animal than the church. We all know that, don't we? It is everything that the church is not. If the church points up, the world points down. If the church is for it, you can be sure that the world is against it. If the church is north, the world is south. The church loves Christ, and the world hates Christ. The church loves the Word of God, and the world hates it. The church is merciful, and the world is vengeful. The church is forgiving, and the world is unforgiving. The church is full of joy, and the world is full of bitterness. The church is righteous, and the world is wicked. The church is a lamb, and the world is a lion. And in our text, the church loves, and the world hates. Now, last week, we saw six reasons why the world hates Christians. Now, I'm not going to review all of those, but just know that the world hates Christians primarily because they hate Christ. They only hate you because you have identified with Him. And why do men hate Him so much? First of all, it is because this world is the battleground between God and Satan. The Bible teaches that there is a spiritual contest going on that is beyond our senses. Spiritual warfare is being waged on a grand scale. And if our eyes could perceive such things, it would surely astound us to see what is going on in this unseen world. There is something going on between God and Satan that filters down into this world. And Satan and his servants, Satan has his servants and God has his servants. And there is a spiritual conflict which plays a major role in the world's hatred of Christ. Indeed, this spiritual warfare is a major underlying factor that impacts our Christian experience. Take a look at Ephesians chapter 6, if you will. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 12, where Paul says, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places." You see, it seems like we are wrestling against flesh and blood. We have to protect ourselves against thieves and robbers. We have to watch our neighbors. We can't always trust our own families. We have to keep our eyes on our own government, lest they would devour us. But the intelligentsia behind the world are those spiritual forces that drive this world, you see. And the world hates our captain primarily because they serve another captain. The world is the front line of Satan's army, and for that reason they hate Christ. But I would have you know that the world hates Christ also because Christ shines the light on their sins. You see, the world likes to think it is righteous, don't they? And the world puts on this cloak of righteousness, and they walk around like they are good and decent and even religious and pious people. But when Jesus came, he uncloaked them. We saw that last week. He stripped away that covering and laid them bare. Take a look at John 15:22. Jesus said, "If I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin." Now, not that they were not sinners, but they would not have seen it as clearly. And he says, "But now they have no cloak for their sin." And this was part of the ministry of Christ while he was on the earth, to expose sin. And it is still a part of the ministry of Christ through his church. That is the ministry of uncloaking sin and sinners. And sinners don't like to be uncloaked. Christ exposes sinners. Christ shines his light into dark places, and the filth of humanity is exposed for all to see. The world is uncloaked by the righteous lives of those in the church. Do you understand that this morning? Christ isn't personally here in bodily form now, but he's here through us. And we are performing the same ministry that Jesus performed, and the world is uncloaked by our lives. You and me are a testimony against the world. It is your life that stands in stark contrast to the life of a worldly man. Your life, by its godly difference, exposes and uncloaks the sin of the world, and the world hates you for it. So out of love to his disciples, Christ now is educating them and giving them warning that the world is a hateful place. Now, the world is a very much different thing or place from our little family here, isn't it? When we come into our building and leave the world out there and meet together as a church family, we can breathe out a sigh of relief. We happily greet one another. We treat each other with grace and with love. We try to meet one another's needs as best we can. We share in each other's sufferings. We esteem one another better than ourselves. The truth and the beauty of the Scriptures ring out in this sanctuary and is joyfully received by the people. But when you go out there, there is something different in the atmosphere. Out there is a world of self-interest. Out there are the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. And the difference between the church and the world is the difference between night and day. Christ characterized it this way: it is the difference between love and hate. I want us here at Grace Baptist Church always to be a loving church, because this is what sets apart Christ's people from the world. A church without love is no church at all. A church without love is a worldly association pretending to be a church. And I want us here to meet the high standard of Christ by loving one another as Christ first demonstrated and then commanded. Now, when we come to chapter 16, Christ continues his warnings to his disciples about a hateful world. And he tells them these things for two reasons. First, he warns them so that they would not be offended. This is found in verse 1, chapter 16 and verse 1. Jesus tells them why he is warning them about hate in the world. He says, "These things have I spoken unto you, that you should not be offended." And then if you look down in verse 4, there's a second reason why he tells them. He warns them so that when persecutions come, they will remember that they were warned. Take a look at verse 4. It says, "But these things have I told you, that when the time come, ye may remember that I told you of them." Now, let's take a look at these one at a time. Jesus warned them, first of all, so that they would not be offended. Now, this word offended might better be translated shaken. Jesus warned them of the hatred of the world so that they would not be shaken, so that they would not be moved from the faith and stumble into unbelief when these persecutions would come to them. Remember how I told you that apostasy is the greatest danger? Jesus warned his disciples of the trouble to come so that they would not be shaken loose from their faith when the hatred of the world turned into persecution. This is the great danger, not only for the disciples, but for all of us. When troubles come, and they will, when sufferings come, and they will, when men hate you because of the cross of Christ, and they will you be offended by the cross which you are called on to bear? Will the cross of Christ be too much for you to carry? Will you be shaken from the faith when it costs you your friends and your family? Will you be shaken loose? When it costs you your life, will you cut ties with Christ? Notice that Jesus told them exactly what would happen to them. Look in verse 2. Jesus told them, "They shall put you out of the synagogues." Now, Matthew Henry calls this the first sword of persecution which would be drawn against the disciples after Jesus went away. It is the sword of ecclesiastical censure. And Jesus said, "They shall put you out of the synagogues." In other words, they would be excommunicated from whatever synagogue they belonged to. Now, they would be deemed heretics by the Jews, and they would be cast away and cut off from the religious life in Israel. Now, apparently, when you were thought to be a religious heretic in Israel, you were delivered up to the religious councils for questioning. And if you did not pass the test and answer the questions just right, then you were banned from the synagogue. But before they let you go, they would tie you up and scourge you. They would whip you across the back with flesh-tearing objects, and they were allowed by law to give you 40 lashes. Now, what they typically did in their religious legality was to give you 40 lashes, what, less one. That was in case they miscounted, they would still be within the confines of the law, you see. And the design of the scourging was to whip you to the point of death without crossing that line. It was a brutal humiliation. It was an unthinkable brutality. Now let me show you how Jesus warned his disciples about this. Take a look at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, and let's take a look at verse 16. So flip to Matthew 10 and 16 and 17. It reads like this. This is Jesus speaking. "Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves, but beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. And in our text, Jesus again warns the disciples that they would be cast out of the synagogues, you see. He was not warning them so that they could avoid it, by the way, but he was warning them so that they would not be shaken from the faith when it happened. You see, Christ is the only captain who tells you what you are going to suffer before you get to the battlefield. What if General Eisenhower, this is a long time ago, but most of us probably have some recollection of that. What if General Eisenhower walked into the barracks one evening and said, "Boys, tomorrow we are storming the beach at Normandy. And let me just tell you now, Private, you are going to step on a mine and lose both legs. Private Jack Ray, you're going to be shot in the face and lose your eyesight. Private Johnny Dunn, I'm sorry, son, but you will receive mortal gunshot wounds and you will suffer and lay on the beach for 2 days and then you will die. Major McNair, your aircraft will be shot down and you will be captured and tortured by the enemy." You see, human captains don't tell you the bad news ahead of time, but Christ does. And He does so because He only wants the most loyal soldiers in His army. And He doesn't want His loyal soldiers to be shaken from their loyalty when the time comes. Let me just say, beware of the health and wealth preachers who mislead you and tell you that Christianity is all about having it all in this life. No, Christianity is about giving it all up in this life. Christianity is about dying to self so that Christ might live through you. Christianity is about being an expendable soldier in the army of Christ. Christianity is not about gaining riches here, but about being willing to be a pauper here for Christ. Christianity is knowing that trouble and suffering will follow, but you will be loyal anyway. And Christ told them these things in order that they might not be shaken in their faith. But look what else they would suffer. Not only would they be put out of the synagogues in verse 2, but they would suffer the ultimate indignity. They would be killed. It says in chapter 16, verse 2, "They shall put you out of the synagogues. Yea, the time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God service." So you see here that Jesus told His disciples that they would ultimately be killed by religious zealots. History and tradition seems to confirm that almost all of the disciples were martyred for their faith. Some were killed by the sword. Some were stoned to death. Some, like the Apostle Paul, was apparently beheaded. Tradition suggests that Philip and Peter were crucified and crucified upside down. James was taken to the top of the temple and pushed off. It seems that only John, the writer of our gospel, escaped a violent death. Of course, John lived a life of persecution, being exiled to Patmos for a long period of time. The Apostle Paul, curiously, lived on both sides of martyrdom. Before Paul was saved, he put Christians to death. And let's just read about that in Acts 26. Acts 26, starting in verse 9. It says there, "I verily thought with myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem, and many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. And I punished them oft in every synagogue, and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even unto strange cities." Whereupon I, as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priests and so forth, it tells of his conversion. And then when Paul became a Christian, he likewise suffered many things and was persecuted often. We see this in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, starting in verse 23, he says, "Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors more abundantly, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequent, in deaths oft. Of the Jews, five times received I 40 stripes, save one." Can you imagine? Five times being scourged to the point of death. "Thrice or three times was I beaten with rods," he says. "Once I was stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeyings often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils by mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness." Those are the things that Paul suffered on behalf of Christ. And so Christ told his disciples, "They shall put you out of the synagogues and they will kill you." Now, I want you to notice that troubles and sufferings and persecutions that come upon Christians are predestinated. There's that word again. That word that the world hates. And they hate it because the word predestination implies that God is a sovereign God in control of all things. No wonder that word evokes the wrath of men in the world. But you see that the concept is here in our text. Jesus told his disciples that the time is coming. That is, it was a certainty. There was an appointed time for persecution, and that time was coming. It is good for us to know as Christians that sufferings are not unfortunate twists of fate. Rather, they are times of appointment. In the plan of God, they have their place. In the plan of God, sufferings have their purpose. They are not suffered in vain, but they are suffered with an eye to the glory of God and with an eye to great personal gain. There are several things that you should know about your pain and your suffering. First of all, know that whatever comes upon you has come under the watchful eye of God. God never turns His head and leaves you unattended. Are pains and sufferings coming upon you? Then know that your God sees them and allows them for His glory and for your good. Not only does He allow them, but in His great wisdom, He has ordained them. Secondly, know that all of your suffering is very light affliction when the whole picture is in view. If you could only imagine, there was a song like that, wasn't it? I can only imagine. But if you could only imagine the overwhelming joy which is yours for all eternity, you would view your present afflictions as very light indeed. And not only are your sufferings light, but they are momentary, the Bible teaches. Your sufferings seem long now, but when you are resting comfortably in the luxury of God's heaven, you will realize that your sufferings were nothing but a blink of the eye. And then know that your sufferings are appointed unto you to work a glorious work in you. These things are taught in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 17. If you'll flip over there quickly, 2 Corinthians 4:17. And in this great verse, 2 Corinthians 4:17, Paul says, "For our light affliction." Now remember who's saying this. This is a man that was scourged 5 times, beaten with rods, stoned, and to where it appeared he was dead. Many other sufferings. And he says, "For our light affliction, which is but for what? A moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." Now, we don't understand that, do we? But we trust it by faith. It's working something for us that far exceeds the extent of our suffering here. So why did Jesus tell them, these disciples, these things? First of all, Jesus told them so that their faith would not be shaken when these sufferings came on them. And in a similar vein, in verse 4, he tells them so that they might remember that he told them. Now, when suffering came upon the disciples, and when it comes upon us, it was good for them, and it will be good for us to remember that Christ has told us that they will come. It serves to confirm in us not only the predestinating foresight of Christ, but also His great faithfulness to us. For He hasn't hidden these things from us. Christ did not deceive us into following Him, but He told us ahead of time that we would suffer. This advance notice of suffering makes our trouble less grievous, for we were told that they were coming. Now, if we were taught these things, then we took up our profession of Christ expecting that we should suffer. Our ailments do not take us by surprise. And when afflictions come, we don't think something has gone wrong in the universe, you see, because Christ has told us that there will be suffering. And when these things come upon us, we remember the words of Christ that these things are appointed unto us. I want to point out to you that the suffering that Christ had in view for these disciples was the suffering of persecution. Although they certainly suffered many things, many other things, severe persecution perhaps was the most terrorizing of all. And I want to take a brief look here at the prosecutors. No, not the prosecutors, the persecutors. The persecutors, because Christ describes them here in our text. In verse 2, you will notice first that those who would persecute the disciples would do so out of religious conviction. They thought they were serving God. And take a look at verse 2. "The time cometh that whosoever killeth you will think that he doeth God service." Now, more people have been killed in the name of God than in any other name. Everyone in the world is religious. I hope you now understand that. And most religions authorize the killing of heretics. As Christians, you and I are considered infidels by the Muslims and infidels by many other religious groups. According to their doctrine, we are the great Satan, and they think that they are doing God a service by killing Christians. And this is the way Christians were treated by the Jewish community in the early church. Christians were the enemy, you see, of the Jewish religion. And they thought Christians were the enemy of God. And so the Jewish leadership went about killing Christians. Religion is a very dangerous thing. Religious conviction allows a man to commit all kinds of sin under the cover of religious authority. Religion allows and sometimes encourages men to kill their adversaries. Religion allows men to treat other men with great contempt and with hatred. Religion many times gives a license for men to indulge their sinful lusts and to act contrary to every good grace that the true God approves. And so beware the doctrines and the evil deeds of religious men. You see, they killed the very disciples of Jesus, thinking that they were doing God service. They thought they were doing God service, but in reality, they killed the disciples because the Bible says, and Jesus said, they did not know God. Look in verse 4. And these things I have told you because they, the persecutors, have not known the Father nor me. This teaches us that there is a great blindness in the world, and there is great blindness in the religions of the world. Satan himself has devised great counterfeit religions to confuse and to confound the world. And there are certain characteristics of all of Satan's religions. First of all, the false religions of the world will generally deny the person of Jesus Christ. They will deny His humanity, and they will deny His deity, and they will deny that He is the Creator of the world. And if they tacitly acknowledge Him in some way, they nevertheless deny His work. They deny that He died for sins. They deny that He rose from the grave. Secondly, every one of these false religions will feature salvation by works. Just watch for that. Christianity is the only one that promulgates a salvation by grace. God has clearly said that salvation is by faith and not by works, and yet men's religion will feature works every time. And so when you perceive that a religious organization promulgates a system of works in order to please God, you better run. Thirdly, false religions will generally claim some authority other than the Scriptures. Mormons have the works of, is it Joseph Smith? I think it's Joseph Smith, isn't it? Islam has the work of Muhammad. Christian Science has Mary Baker Eddy. The Catholic Church has a whole set of books called the Apocrypha, which they consider authority. And any time you find extra biblical authority, you have found a false religion. Fourthly, most importantly, false religions generally will have great antagonism and hatred for Christ and for Christians. They may outwardly and tacitly acknowledge and claim some affinity for Christ, but inwardly and ultimately, they will hate Him. And in our text, the Jews, who were the most religious people in the world, hated Christ and put Him to death. And they hated the disciples and they put them to death. And many other Christians were put to death in the name of the Jewish religion. But they did this because their religion was devoid of any knowledge of God, you see. Jesus said, they have not known the Father nor me. Let me conclude here by summing up what all of this means to us. First of all, by the grace of God, you and I live in a part of the world where Satan and his servants are restrained from harming Christians as they would like to do. Our country was established with certain safeguards which allow us religious freedom. Furthermore, we have the best legal system in the world. Though it is not perfect, it protects us to a large extent from the murderous intent of sinful men. From our founding, there has been a certain commitment in our country to Christian principles, such as liberty and freedom and the basic dignity of human life. There is protection of human rights built into our Constitution. We have the greatest Constitution ever known to man. Now, these days, our Christian influence is waning, it seems. But there are still many Christians scattered throughout our country. And for all of these reasons, and perhaps many more, Satan and evil men are greatly hindered and restrained from persecuting Christians in the United States of America. And you and I can get up every Sunday morning and come to a true church, a true New Testament church, and worship Jesus Christ freely and without serious interruption or persecution. With all of our problems, we are still the greatest country on the face of the earth. But in all other parts of the world, or in other parts of the world, where Christians are greatly in the minority, and where there are many false religions and few legal restraints, and where there are no repercussions for killing people, Christians are routinely persecuted and killed. We have missionaries who we support who fear for their lives when they go into the mission field. This is because the world hates Christ and they hate Christians. Jesus was very gracious to tell us these things so that we will not be shaken when it happens to us. It is very likely that Christians will suffer persecution even in our country. Already, conservative and Christian groups are being targeted by governmental agencies for special harassment. Legal rights and privileges for Christian churches may soon be in jeopardy. And as the hedges are being torn down, Satan and the world will look to persecute Christians all the more. If they could, they would put a mark in our foreheads and exclude us from our national community. If they could, they would take away our voting privileges. They would interfere with our ability to make a living, if only they could. There is no doubt in my mind that if only they could, they would have us scourged and even killed. Don't underestimate the hatred of the world toward Christ. It will rear its ugly head over and over again. May the Lord help you. May the Lord help me. May the Lord help us as a church to stand fast in the face of many troubles.